copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
What we want to do is, as well as thinking about how to preach epistles, and we've talked about that, and especially not all the details, we decided instead of going through every single aspect of sermon preparation, we feel like, well, this is the advanced network, let's push into certain challenges. And so that's why we focused on Tuesday, was it Monday? I can never get the days right here, but focusing first of all on that doctrinal section and how do you preach from that kind of a section with relevance and application when it isn't conduct only, you know. And then we thought about the more conduct instructional sections and how do you preach those without turning them into something that they aren't, which is just instructions, just an instruction manual for independent living. So how do we keep that in connection with the gospel, both within the context and within the whole book? And I think those are two of the really big issues in preaching epistles. But one of the other issues that I want us to think about in this session, and this may not even take the whole session, so we can discuss other things. Feel free to push for that. But just thinking about preaching epistles, one of the challenges is just that epistles are familiar. People know them. And it just feels like, well, an epistle will tend to be same old truths preached in the same old way. And so I don't know if what your church is like, but if I think in some churches, if somebody announces we're going to do a series in the book of Nahum, people go, oh, this could be interesting. You know, we're going to do a series on the life of Christ. Great. I love the miracles, you know, but an epistle, this is going to be heavy. This is going to be dull. You know, this is going to be the same old every week, exactly the same. And so I want us to think about that and think about how can we avoid that and how can we be able to go into our situations and preach from an epistle and preach confidently and preach creatively and preach so that people benefit. Okay, so let's just work our way through the notes. I think a lot of this is just making sense of the comments in there and helping us to think through it. But we'll just use that as a map just to guide us along. So I put here, first of all, I didn't put here, but it's put here, familiarity breeds. In English, we have this phrase, familiarity breeds contempt. Okay, so familiar, I know that. I'm contemptuous. I dismiss it. You know, and so somebody that you don't know, somebody famous, you know, you meet them, you get excited for some reason. You know, but if you know them your whole life, that's just Don Carson. He used to live next door. That's Don. You know, but if you don't know him, you know, then maybe that's a problem too. But with epistles, we don't want to have that attitude. Oh, that's just Ephesians. Yeah, I know Romans. Yeah. What's left to say about Romans? You know, and so what are we talking about in terms of familiarity? First of all, let's think in terms of familiar to the preacher. The book that you're looking at is familiar to you. There are some dangers there. The first one, I've already done this. I've preached this one before, so all I have to do is open the filing cabinet, pull out the notes, Sunday morning, oh yeah. All right, this passage that we're going to look at this morning has transformed my life this week. Yeah, Ephesians, that's right. You know, and we can fall into that trap, right, of just pulling out old notes and preaching old sermons, and it feels like old food. It's just not fresh. Any thoughts about that? How can we avoid that? Should we never reuse a message? Should we reuse a message? What do you think? Yeah, we need to relive it. We need to go back into it so that it's fresh, even if it's still using old exegesis. Do we need to do more exegesis? Okay, so we've changed. Our theology hopefully has developed. We've been reading the Bible, hopefully. All right. So I don't want to ask for a show of hands because this could be embarrassing, but if you've ever read through the whole Bible, which I hope you have, and then read through it again, was it boring the second time? No, it's different. It's not different, but you are different. And so there should be a sense that I could preach Ephesians 10 years ago, this year, 5 years' time, 15 years' time, 20 years' time, and every time it should be more and more rich to me, and therefore. Now, does that mean I should ignore the old notes? Are the old notes useful or not? It's challenging the idea, and it's worth challenging the idea, that if people have heard it, they've got it. We know that if they've heard it, they can't even remember it, usually. You know, and the goal isn't for them to remember it, it's for them to be changed by it. You know, so it's more than remembering. And so there's a lot to be said for that. I remember hearing somebody ask Haddon Robinson, should you reuse an old sermon? And he said, yes and no. He said, no, it should never be an old sermon. It should be new as you preach it, in the sense that you enter into it so that you're preaching from the heart rather than from notes, if you know what I mean. It's not just, let me read this to you, but let me give. But he said, if a sermon is good enough to preach once, it's good enough to preach twice. This idea that the Spirit works with us to prepare one message, but then leaves us if we dare to use it again. You know, it's kind of a strange logic, but I see exactly what you're saying, that what if we do exactly the same thing again? Well, maybe they need it. Maybe they, you know, there's still a value to that, because sometimes I've listened to sermons that are recorded and I've gone back and listened to it again and benefited again more. So there's a real value to that. Actually, I remember one thing Andy Stanley said, who's, you know, not saying I affirm everything Andy Stanley said, but he said a lot of sermons would make good series. You know, you hear a normal sermon, maybe it's 3 or 4 points. He says basically each one of those points should be its own sermon. And we kind of rush through it. Oh, I'm my next point. Hi, I'm my next point. I'm my next point. Okay, got it. Okay, good, go. And then tonight, let's do another one. And Christians just kind of feel like this overwhelmed, you know, constant torrent of information. And he says, oh, hang on a minute, why don't we spend several weeks in the same passage? You know, it's not breaking the passage up necessarily, but really allowing time for that passage to work into us as a congregation. I think that's true for us as preachers. So yeah, I think we should avoid simplistic ideas like every sermon must be brand new. If you've done exegesis in the past, start with that and then go deeper. You know, and everything that Pavel just said in terms of the people needing it again. The second thing on here, I know this one. This is something we need to be really wary of, the idea that I've already got that passage figured out. That's why we do need to go back to them, even if we say, you know, I preached this sermon. Maybe I preached this sermon and it won an award. You know, I won the Romanian Preacher of the Year award with this sermon. Still work it again if you have the time. Now, obviously, if it's Sunday morning and you get a phone call and they say the preacher who is coming to preach has had a car problem, he cannot be here, can you preach in 1 hour? Is it okay to pull out the notes? Exactly. But if you have 1 hour, maybe take, you know, it takes half an hour to get to church, you take half an hour and say, okay, Lord, I've only got half an hour. Passage open, notes. You know, God knows. Now, if you've got 2 weeks to prepare and you only take half an hour, God also knows. But I don't think that God is going to get us because the circumstances make something impossible. Okay, so what about, I put on, or the notes say number 3 there, look at what God is saying to us. That's that Don Sanuki and the devotional life of the preacher. That's the real danger, isn't it? That we're doing preaching rather than we're preaching from the overflow of a personal walk with Christ. There should be that personal relationship, and from that, I think there's nothing. I don't want to overstate it, but there's a massive, massive problem with technically trained preachers who preach technically good sermons with technically accurate theology, and they do it technically in a good way. Their delivery is engaging and compelling, and so on. But there's no connection between them and God. They may be evangelical, born again, but essentially the relationship is very cold. How is that much different than having a liberal who doesn't believe in God preaching? You know what I mean? I think that I don't want to beat the drum and just keep saying that, but I kind of will, because that's a massive danger for us. The more we learn, the more we know, the more sophisticated we think we are, the more likely we are to fall into pride. And pride really is at the root of all sorts of sin problems for us. And so the idea of the ongoing freshness in our ministry is really important. What about when it's familiar to the preacher and the congregation? The danger of information transfer. So number one there, what else is there to say? If you think for, I remember one example that actually may not fit here, but I was at a conference, a preaching conference, and that all the preachers had the same title, the theme of the conference, which was preaching the gospel in an age of idolatry, something like that. And so it was like 5 days, every preacher, all 25 of them, seemed to preach either Exodus 32 or Acts 17. You know, just like every session. Oh, you know. But we got to one morning and we'd had two or three messages already on Acts 17, and N.T. Wright spoke. And, you know, again, I'm not affirming everything N.T. Wright says, but one thing he does do well is he knows the context. He knows what's going on in that part of the, you know, Second Temple Judaism, and he kind of definitively covered Acts 17. It felt like that's the best commentary I've ever read. He really, Stoics, Epicureans, what's going on, Areopagus, full explanation of the whole thing. That evening, same day, preacher stands up, and he changed his message from something else to Acts 17. And everyone's going, I heard this morning and yesterday and the day before, and he didn't add much. It really did feel like he was just reusing what had impacted him that morning. And in that case, it was kind of like, you really should have preached something else. Now, do we have that same situation in the church where we say, well, I preached from Ephesians last year, and then I preached from Ephesians 2 years before that. There's nothing left to say from Ephesians. I think there's a problem with that assumption. I think it's the idea that there's Ephesians contains information, and I have communicated that information, and so the listeners, like a cup, requiring the Ephesians information, have downloaded the Ephesians information. You see, I think that idea, if that's what preaching is, we could just hand out some commentaries. All right, just be done. Here, you've got the information, right? It's up to you if you read it or not. Preaching's more than that. What about if it's an organic, a responsive, relational growth, so that just like for us, we say we read through the Bible, we read through it again, we read through it again, and every time it gets better and richer and it touches us and it speaks to us in different ways and so on. It doesn't change, but we are. The same applies to preaching, right? Just because people know the content doesn't mean that preaching the content at this point is not going to be helpful. It should be. Would you agree with that? It's more than just the information. The second one here, same kind of idea. He put changed lives versus good memories. I think we can fall into that trap of thinking, I've preached this passage before. They will remember that I've preached this passage before. They won't, yes, right? Maybe we should try it just to realize how little impact our preaching may be having in terms of education. Now, hopefully over time, lives are being changed, even though they can't remember all our sermons. That's the point. But if we think, oh, I preached this last year, can't do it now because everyone will say, oh, you're just being lazy. It's not the reality. The real challenge is what Pavel is saying is, have they assimilated? Has this done its work? Probably not. There's still more to be done. We're not complete yet. And so was it John Stott? I think John Stott was, I'm going really from memory here, something like he was talking or writing. He said, if the congregation doesn't understand grace, I would preach through 1 Peter. And when I get to the end, I would start from the beginning and I'd preach through 1 Peter again. And if I get to the end, I go back to the beginning and I preach through 1 Peter again, and I would do that until it breaks open over them. Something that's like that kind of a phrase, until they really get it. You know, and that's that. Are they going to remember that he's preached 1 Peter for the past 4 years? Yes. Have their lives been changed by it the way they should be? Not yet. Keep going. And so that's another example. Ortiz, Stott, similar kind of people, right? It's a joke. So same idea from different theological perspective. familiar to the congregation only. I don't think this is going to apply to us, but it could apply to people that we work with. What if somebody's a young preacher and they feel like these people know it better than me? They've probably had Philippians 54 times, and here I come as a 25-year-old and I'm going to preach Philippians. I don't even know it as well as some of these people do. What would you say to somebody? You were coaching. Okay, so let's say that we're coaching our brother, and he shares this concern. I won't put it on you. So there's somebody in your church, and he says, hey, I'm 24, 22. I can't preach Philippians or Ephesians to these people. They know it. What would you say to that person? You're mentoring them. You're encouraging them. And hopefully as well, if you preach and look at the people you're preaching to once in a while, then I think you cannot avoid but changing slightly, because you're responsive to the people in front of you. If you just read your sermon like this, maybe it'll be identical. But if you're a human and you're going to, you know, look at people sometimes, then that's going to happen. I would say look at them the whole time, but, you know, I don't want to put the pressure on too much. Now, what do we, just kind of stepping sideways slightly from the notes and going backwards through a door into a new area, but the whole issue of mentoring other preachers, let's think about that for a few minutes. Because if we come to this, I think for many of us, the training that we get here at ELF, which is very modest, it's very brief, may be the only preaching training we get, or certainly would be more than most people have, let's put it that way. And I wish it could be so much more. There's so much that we could do if we had more time. But if all we do is take this and preach better ourselves, then maybe 15 congregations will benefit. But if we go away with the mindset of, I want to develop other preachers, I want to multiply, I want to entrust to others what has been entrusted to me so that they can, you know, pass it on and it can multiply. You think of the potential of that. If each one of us over the next year or 2 years or 3 years mentor two or three or four other preachers, they can be preached in churches that we can't be in. You know, I like preaching. I love preaching. But given the option of preaching to 5,000 people or training 12 preachers, I'd go with training 12 preachers. Because the following Sunday, 12 times small church, and again, ultimately is going to be more than one times 5,000. And so let's think about that together. What could that look like? What does it look like? Any experiences we want to share? Let's just think about mentoring and bringing along others in the ministry of preaching. I just think of my colleague at Cordeo, Ron Frost. He's this isn't directly to do with preaching, but one of the things he likes to do is to get a read-through partner when he reads through his Bible. He goes about three times a year, and every time he finishes reading through, he's looking for another person to read through with. And they just get together once a week, share highlights from what they've read, and he's found over 30, 40 years that it's the best, most effective discipleship approach that he's ever seen in terms of the percentage of people that just go crazy spiritually, just really take off, you know, in a good way. He says it's just fantastic. But I remember him telling a story about 2 years ago. He was in his church. This is a church in America, and he's just as a comment as he was preaching, he said, "I just finished my Bible read through. If anyone's interested in reading through the Bible over the next 3 or 4 months with me, come and see me afterwards. I'll be over here." And the guy who came to speak to him and did the read through with him was also there. I heard it from both sides, and he said, "When I heard that, I thought, that's what I want to do. And here we are in a church of 2,000 people. I better run." You know, and he got to the end of his sermon, finished the meeting, and the guy, I forget his name now, but he said, "I ran to the front and I was the only one." You know, and Ron wasn't surprised by that. He said, "Yeah, there's never many. But what I do is I just say, Lord, who is there? Give me one. I need one." And over the years, he's got, you know, 50 years, 150 stories or 100 stories of the ones that he's been able to spend time in the Bible with. You know, but his advice would always be pray about it. You know, say, Lord, who? You know, and I think our tendency is they should all want this. They should all want to grow as preachers. They should all come to me for mentoring. You know, but actually it may be that there's 6 possible people and we only get to really pour into one, but it's worth it for that one. Because what will probably happen is that one will develop as a preacher where the others don't quite so much. And so the others still are occasional preachers. This one may end up preaching in other churches and serving churches and being, you know, giving more spiritually. So, you know, I think we look at the ministry of Jesus and, you know, you see the ministry with the 5,000 and the, you know, the crowds, but he was always prioritizing the 12. And I think we can be caught up with the, we want bigger church, we want bigger Sundays, we want bigger numbers. But the really the crowds are the context in which to find the small numbers. And it's the pouring into a small number that's going to multiply ministry, not the preaching to crowds. So I'm not despising that. It's good to have more. I wish all of our churches had twice as many people in them, obviously. But if we're putting all our energy into making that bigger, but we're not putting our time into mentoring, because that's the other side of it. Peter, you say they don't have the time. Often with preachers, it's the preacher that doesn't have the time. We make ourselves too busy, but I would say we've got to prioritize that. If we're going to have a legacy, if we're going to make a difference, it's much better to do less ourselves in order to equip others to do more. So let's look at the next page, page 3. I think if we can all go away from here thinking and praying, Lord, what can we do to multiply? You know, even if our ministry is modest, how can we help somebody else to move forward? That would probably be the best result of this entire week. It's the method Jesus used. You know, Jesus wasn't a classroom guy. He was really very much of a mentoring, relational, developing people. And he didn't pick the elite either. You know, he didn't look for who are the strategic leaders. He took a group of very humble people with the wrong accent, you know, who had no training, who'd failed in Sabbath school, you know, and he took them and he made them world changers. And so I think we can learn a lot from that. Why preach the familiar passage? Here's the question, because on certain occasions, it seems right to preach something that's very familiar. Do you know what I mean? Like Christmas and Easter. If you preach Ezekiel 34 on Christmas Eve, I mean, in some cultures, I know you do that because you don't acknowledge Christmas. I know in Italy, for example, some churches just pretend Christmas doesn't exist because it's a pagan festival or because of the Catholic abuse of Epiphany or whatever. But I understand that. But even so, Easter. I'd like to think that most churches recognize Easter. You don't want to preach something that's unrelated on that day. So does that mean that we end up preaching the same thing year after year after year? Now, let's take the example of Christmas. You've got a pre-Christmas series. You've got your what?
Christmas.
This coming Sunday?
Yeah,
that's nice.
Do you do, it's not an official.
Do you do presents and everything?
Well, it'd be nice. Yeah,
that's a thought. So that's just local church, that's not cultural or something I'm missing, right?
Just because we're doing Luke 1 and 2.
Great, yeah. Now, when you come around to the normal Christmas, I know you want to have Christmas. You're Australian, you get your seasons all confused, right? You know. So when you're, let's say, normal situation, December comes, it's the time where people come, in my culture, people expect, they come to church maybe once a year, they expect to hear about Mary and Joseph and donkey and stable and all that kind of stuff. I tend to disappoint them with donkey and stable because I don't see it even when I'm in Luke and Matthew. But still, the standard passages are what they're expecting. And so, first of all, there's a good reason to go to those, right? And that is that people are expecting it. It's like when you have a child, bedtime story, what would you like me to read? Read Frankie and His Football. Again, we did that one last night. Yeah, 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 let's do that one. And the night before. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, how about we do this? No, 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 I want Frankie and His Football or whatever. You know, children love the same story over and over again. Adults don't mind that either. Adults watch movies more than once, the same movie. You know, some people watch the same Star Trek 4,000 times. That's a bit of an addiction, I think. But, you know, you watch a good film, Gladiator or something, you watch it again, right? And I think there's that sense that it's not because you don't know what's going to happen, but because the experiencing of that story, it creates an effect in the person anyway. Oh, I like this bit. This bit makes me feel this way. Or I don't think there's anything wrong with preaching the same passages. So Christmas, Matthew 1 and 2, Luke 1 and 2. You could easily do that year after year after year. The problem is, it can get a little bit dull for the preacher. So let's say you want to do something less familiar. Where could you go for Christmas messages other than Matthew 1 and 2, Luke 1 and 2?
Galatians?
4:4? Yeah, at the right time, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law. And you can just go in and preach that, and it's a nice little three-pointer within the verse, but put it in its context, you're really preaching the gospel in terms of not under law, but in Christ, you know, not separated, but by the Spirit brought into a relationship with Abba so that God can become, I mean, it's a rich passage. But yeah, you can still refer to the story from that, because it's referring to God sent forth his son, born of a woman. You know, it's obviously it's tying back to Genesis 3, and it's making the big theological, biblical connections, but we shouldn't dismiss the story. Where else could you go?
Isaiah 7.
Okay, so go backwards. Yeah, Isaiah 7, Isaiah 9, Micah 5, John 1 as well.
14,
yeah, became flesh and dwelt among us, which you can then tie back, obviously, to Exodus 33, 34, and all the themes that John is obviously referring back to. He pitched his tent among us. We beheld his glory, full of grace and truth. No one has seen God but God, who is at the Father's side, the one and only. He has made him known. You can end up doing a nice, informative, life-transforming kind of, this is Jesus, look who he is. So yeah, we can do the same passages with different angles. We can go to other passages. So the one excuse we shouldn't have is that I, as a preacher, am growing tired of this. But I've heard that. I've heard a lot of people saying, oh, Christmas, I hate Christmas, I don't know what to preach. I'm like, oh, for goodness sake, get out of the pastorate. You know, if you don't want to preach the word, you're not in it enough. It's better than you realize. So yeah, and same thing with Easter. Other occasions as well, funerals, weddings, things like that. What's the obvious passage for a wedding? Ephesians 5. Oh, yeah, okay, the wedding at Cana. Yeah, that's always awkward. Genesis 2. Some of you probably want to avoid, like Matthew 19 and Mark 10 and the sort of divorce passages, right? But yeah, there's quite a few that give some variety. Psalm 45, it's a wedding psalm. But if sometimes you will have people that say, I'm not sure, what do you think? You know, but if they ask you, if I was doing 10 weddings in a row in 10 weeks and every couple wanted Ephesians 5, I'd preach it because it's their wedding. And the people that are coming to their wedding, are some of them will be different people because of family coming in. Yeah, and there's obviously 1 Corinthians 13 is a common one in some cultures as well. How much do you put that in its context? You know, this is the middle of 12 to 14, and actually the real issue is spiritual gifts. Yeah, you don't want to be harsh in that situation, but I would feel an integrity issue if I treated it as if it was talking about marriage. You know what I mean? So I think you can subtly, you know, just make gentle comments, say this is part of this context. But the reason we tend to pull it out on its own is because what it says is so rich. Now what it means in this context is this, but let's look at it in our context. You know, I think something like that would satisfy most people. I don't think God is going to judge me if I'm asked to preach 1 Corinthians 13 verses 4 to 8. And I do that, but I do feel guilty if I pretend it's about marriage. It can be applied to marriage, just as it can be applied to everything else, but it's really about gift use and motivations in that. Okay, so other occasions, there's, you know, baptisms, we could talk about this. So just thinking, there is variety in passage choice, there's variety in presentation style. I think I probably said this the other day, there isn't total variety in presentation style. You know, if you're preaching at a funeral, it's not the time to go casual. It's not the time to be creative. You know, people want something that's not going to distract them from the fact that they're grieving. They want something to comfort them in the context of grief. You know, so be sensitive, obviously, but you guys know this. Let's go over to the next page. And if we miss something and you want to know what it means, ask Hugh. Okay, so page 4, approaching the text or the sermon creatively, just thinking creatively. The passage in context and the changing exegetical idea. What he means by that is, if you think about the section we had this week, Ephesians 4, 17 to 32, could you preach that as a single passage? I think so. You know, you've got the walking right the way through to the walking. I'd go to 5 verse 2 to make it a full section. But, you know, that you've got an inclusio beginning and end. You've got themes running right the way through. It doesn't completely change at verse 25. So if you take that whole passage and preach it, you will have an exegetical idea or a main idea that reflects those verses. Now, what happens if you preach 17 to 24 and then you preach 25 to 32? Well, you have two ideas that combined would be the whole, but individually, they're going to be phrased differently, right? They're going to be more restricted. And it can go the other way, can't it? If you go from, instead of 4:17 to 5:2, if you went 4:1 to, I don't know, 5:15, something like that, 5:14, sorry, would that be preachable? Yeah. But you'd be going further up the, you know, a tree diagram where you have thing at the top and then it's divided and then each one is divided. You end up like this Christmas tree effect. Moving up and down that tree means that your idea is getting broader or more focused. And so if you're preaching on Ephesians 4 verses 29 to 32, it's narrower, 25 to 32 broader, 17 to end of chapter broader, 4:1 to 5:14 broader, 4:1 to end of the book broader, the whole of Ephesians broader. Does that make sense? The changing the size of the passage will change the feel of the message. It'll change the main idea. It'll also change the pace and how you do it and how you handle the details of that. Anyone here do that? I mean, some churches are very rigid. You know, every sermon is same length, a standard unit, half a chapter, or between the headings in the Bible. Does anybody vary that in their context? Yeah. How much would you vary that? I'd encourage us to consider that, because I think most of us would find going broader challenging. I think some people think big picture, some people think details. Detail people will struggle with big picture. But in January, I preached Ezekiel in a single message, whole book. Thankfully, I didn't have to go into the details of your section. And so your message would have done a more complete job of that section. But Ezekiel does hold together from beginning to end as a single entity. And the, one of the reasons I did that was because I had a lot of people in my church grumbling about Ezekiel. In this, we got people reading through their Bibles in partnerships. And that's a positive thing, right? And it got them, because of the pace, we got them to get past Leviticus, which is the normal complaint zone. You know, people don't like Leviticus because they're trying to read 2 chapters a day and it takes 2 weeks. You know, it's hard work. If you're going through the whole Bible in 3 or 4 months, you get through Leviticus in 3 days, it's not a problem, you know. But once you get to the prophets, I noticed a lot of people were complaining. They found Isaiah hard. I'm like, you're kidding. It is hard, it's huge, but it's a great book. And then you get, you know, Jeremiah. That's pretty heavy going. It's longer than Isaiah. And I think after that, they hit Ezekiel and they go, oh, I cannot cope with this, you know, because it's just all these, you know, wheels and eyes. And so because I was hearing from several different sources, people saying, I don't like Ezekiel. Don't know why that's in the Bible. I thought, I want to change this. And so as part of a series, I preached a message that was the whole of Ezekiel. And actually, after that, people were saying, I want to go back and read Ezekiel because actually it sounds quite exciting. You know, so sometimes you can pick a whole book. And if I'd have chosen to do Ezekiel in 48 weeks, I don't think I would have changed their opinion. But by giving them the bigger picture, it helped them to see that this isn't just detail after detail and woe after woe, but there's something bigger going on here. It's like a sandwich in Ezekiel with the middle bit being the oracles against the nations. But yeah, people sometimes say, well, Martin Lloyd-Jones preached Romans for 3 centuries or whatever it was. Was it 12 years or 7 years or something like that? I think it was 12, wasn't it? And I say, well, okay, if you're as good as Martin Lloyd-Jones, do it, but you're not, so don't. You know, and actually, was he expository in the sense of really explaining the text? Well, no, he was really going from text to whole of theology constantly. So it was a theology class for 12 years. That would be thrilling if it's good. It's the people that copy Lloyd-Jones and Spurgeon and try to do that that tend to kill us, you know, with that. But anyone else, anyone preached whole books? What whole books have been done? I'm not saying look what I've done, but I'm just saying it can be done, and it can be done with profit. I've done Romans in one, Mark in one, Ezekiel in one, obviously Ruth and Jonah, some short ones. What else? Micah in one.
Habakkuk.
Yeah, Habakkuk almost needs to be in one in some ways. I've done 1 Corinthians in one as well. That was a fun message. I was asked to speak at a church anniversary meeting. This was the 80th anniversary of this church. So all these people had come together. They started off with this slideshow of the history of the church, and they showed how back in the 1950s we did children's ministry, but then we had to change and we did this, and then we had to change and we did this. And it was a small church, but it was encouraging. You know, it was, you go, oh, this is good. God has done good things here. And I stood up to preach, and I said, you know, people always say that methods need to change, but the message must not change. I want to suggest that actually, while everything we've seen is good, and I affirm all of that, I think it's great that this church has moved with the times, I think sometimes our message does need to change. And everyone's like, you see these traditional people that were visiting from other churches going, this is a heretic, you know, what's he saying? And they're all twitchy. And I said, our message needs to change when our message isn't what the Bible is actually saying. You know, and so I kind of brought it back, and I said, let me show you what I mean with 1 Corinthians. And I preached the whole of 1 Corinthians, showing the richness, I don't know if this phrase will translate, but in English, I sometimes use this phrase, paper thin. You know, if something's paper thin, it's not got much substance, it's easy to push over. And I think one of the problems in our country is that a lot of the gospel presentation and gospel explanation has become really paper thin. It's just one dimension. It's just one truth. And it doesn't have the fullness of what the Bible assumes. And I use 1 Corinthians to show that, how Paul was speaking of a much richer gospel in response to local church issues. And whole book message, and I think it worked really well with people, not to, you know, I didn't get stoned for heresy, but also afterwards the conversations really showed that people were, oh, you're right. We really do need to think about gospel is more than just simple. And obviously it is simple. You explain the gospel to a 3-year-old, but there's a richness to the gospel and to who God is and to what sin is and to what grace is and so on. So yeah, I think I encourage you to consider preaching whole books. A couple of more things here. Our time is moving forward. Preaching planks instead of slices. What do I mean by that? I'm not an artist, okay? So forgive me for this. If you have a log, okay, piece of tree trunk, yeah, you cut down a tree, you have this big piece of wood, there's two things that you can do with it to prepare it for use. Okay, one way is to cut it like this, to create, how do you do this, a slice. Okay, so it's a section of the whole. And this slice is the standard way that we preach books. Okay, so if we're preaching Ephesians, we break it, we cut it into slices. Okay, and maybe we do different sizes. That's encouraging, you know. But often it will be first half of chapter 1, second half of chapter 1, first half of chapter 2, second half of chapter 2. And we preach like that. And within each slice, we recognize what's there and how it works together. But actually, there's another way to cut wood, right? And that is to cut it this way. Now, if you cut it that way, what do you end up with? You have a plank in English. It's this piece of wood, right, that you'd use for building. And what do you have here? Instead of the rings, you tend to have, let's do this. Okay, so you have these kind of grains, right? And some of the grains maybe don't go the whole way through, some of them do. But if you take a slice of wood and you polish it, it's beautiful. You take a plank and you polish it, it's beautiful in a different way. And they're useful in different ways. And I think one of the things that we need to consider is the fact that we're so conditioned to preach the slices that we never preach the planks. Okay, so on the next page here, let's just look at some of that. I won't read all of this, but Planks and Slices, I just pulled out a post here. So it's on page 5. You just read through some of these headings here. Number 1, every book has grains working through it, and the best way to find them is to spend a lot of time in the book. Okay, so that seems obvious, but if we only spend time in a slice and then preach, we're going to miss the grains. So we need to, as preachers, even if we preach slices, we need to read the whole book to get a feel for the fact that some of these words that only come once in this slice are a big theme through the whole. So for example, in Ephesians, if you just preach verses 3 to 14, the riches of his mercy or riches of his grace, whichever phrase that is, it's only there once. And so in terms of what are you going to emphasize? You're going to emphasize to the praise of his glory, to the praise of his glorious grace, to the praise of his glory. Because that's there multiple times. It's a big feature of that slice. But I think I'm right in saying the riches of his is only there once. But then if you read through the whole section, through the whole book, you discover that it's in that part, it's in the second half of the chapter, it's in the next one, and the next one. It's, I think, five sentences in a row. It's a real grain that's going through that first half of Ephesians. Once you know that, even preaching the slice, you might make a note of that. You might bring out some emphasis that would maybe help to clarify. Equally, heavenly places, is that 7 times through the whole book? In him, 36 times, in him, in Christ. You know, these are grains that we're seeing, and sometimes they won't be obvious features within a section. Often you'll find a section where the word love is only mentioned once, but across a book, the word love could be very significant. And if you only preach slices and you forget what's come before, something could be there 5, 6, 7 times in a series and you hardly mention it. But for Paul, that was a big theme. Does that make sense? Number 2, some grains will be more pronounced than others. Let me see, I've put some examples here. So it's not a competition between grains, but we should be alert to those that are the real building blocks for a book. Romans, if you spot eschatological hope, but miss justification, righteousness, faithfulness, that's an issue. Number 3, some grains will be located in a section. I just talked about the riches of his grace, riches of his mercy, that's just in the first half, rather than through the whole book. 4, it won't be possible to have every grain have impact in a sermon, so select carefully. If you're preaching in John, for example, there's grains through every verse practically. You have to pick what is the most helpful at that point. Number 5, tracing the grain can bring great variety to a series. Instead of just chopping a book into chunks or slices, why not introduce and conclude with an overview that traces a particular grain through the whole? Does that communicate? So maybe start a series in Ephesians with the riches of his grace or something, you know, whatever you pick. Maybe finish the series in Ephesians with walking, the language of walking, which comes both ends, okay? Just finishing up the page 4 really quickly. Taking application seriously, I think we've covered that during the week already. Different audiences will be different. Letter D, a change of perspective. Here's 3 suggestions. They may not be possible in your context, but in terms of creative preaching and creative preaching an epistle, first person preaching. Do we know what first person is? It's when you preach as a character. If you're going to preach Ephesians first person, who might you choose to be? Paul or somebody in Ephesus, yeah? Timothy? Has they got any connection with Ephesians? I'm not sure. Tychicus? I think Tychicus could be an interesting angle. Because a lot of people don't know that somebody wrote an amanuensis. And you know, if you're the amanuensis, you can be very humble describing how amazing what Paul said was. And I just, as I was writing this down, oh my, you know, and he kept coming back to the same ideas. Now, what makes it effective is you've got to know Ephesians like Tychicus would. You can't just prepare this on a Saturday and preach like Tychicus. But you can, if you do the work necessary, preach a sermon that your church will remember for a very long time if you do it well. Okay, so don't be silly, don't do it shortcut. It's hard work to do first person, but once in a while, it's worth it if your church will allow it. If not, do it to the youth group. Okay, but that's one option. Number two, storying. I wish we had time to talk about storying, but storying is actually a field of missiology. It's a discipline being used in missiology in oral cultures, where you have a tribal group and you'll tell a story and then they will retell the story. And by telling and retelling and retelling, they can enter into it so that by the end of the time together, people are feeling the power of that story. And there's a variety of ways for doing that. But for example, if you have a youth group like this, and the standard practice is to take 20 minutes and somebody preaches at them, why not consider, take a very short story and say, listen, I'm going to tell you this story, then I want one of you to tell it. And then we're going to give feedback, and then we'll have somebody else tell it. It may take longer, but what you'll find is that instead of going, oh, here comes the sermon, you can tell a story, Jesus and Zacchaeus, just not even tell it, just read it. Just read it, it's fine. And then have somebody else, hey, close your Bible, and hey, you have a go. And they'll stumble, and they'll make mistakes, and they'll miss bits. And others will go, yeah, it was good, but what about this bit? And what about this bit? And then, okay, great, let's do it again. And you might think, well, what's this for? It enables people to inhabit the story. And then when you come to the end, you may preach a 5-minute message on that experience that you've had together. I tell you, if it goes well, that can be one of the most life-changing ways, because they're not just listening and letting it flow over. They are entering into. That's okay. So I'll let you chew on that. You can look up storying, and there's websites and things about that. But there may be some possibility, even within a church setting, to do that if it's appropriate. And then inductive text work preaching. I made up that title. But what we were doing with Ephesians when we were marking it, I've done that with a church, where as they come in, they're given the handout with the text. I preached through Ruth last year. Every week they had the section printed. And during the sermon at one point, I told them, look through it and mark up this. And I was just very specific. The people. Who are the people? And then interacted, got some observations, then carried on preaching. It's just trying to bring people into the experience of the message. Okay, so those are some ideas that are not so normal, but perhaps have some value. Okay, one more thing here. Where's... I'm confused by my own notes. Yeah, here we go. On page 6... after the planks and slices, there's another three articles online you can look up on that issue. But recommended resources. We've put recommended resources at the end of every set of notes. I've never mentioned them. I've given a few here that may be useful on preaching, on Bible and epistles in general, Ephesians. You may have your own favorites, but if you have your favorites, it probably means you don't really look at these lists. So it's up to you. Bottom of the page... biblicalpreaching.net, we'll mention that in the next section. That's where some of these posts are hosted. You might find that helpful. And cordeo.org, that's the website where we're putting articles. You may, again, find that helpful as a resource as well.